At a time when military conflict is in abeyance everywhere, when an international peace covers all parts of the globe, Lyon, the showpiece of Gaul, is lost to view. Fortune invariably allows those whom she strikes down in the sight of all a chance to fear what they were going to suffer. The fall of anything great generally takes time, but here a single night is all there was between a mighty city and no city at all. It was destroyed, in fact, in less time than I have taken telling you of its destruction. Sturdy and resolute though he is when it comes to facing his own troubles, our Liberalis has been deeply shocked by the whole thing, and he has some reason to be shaken. What is quite unlooked for is more crushing in its effect, and unexpectedness adds to the weight of a disaster. The fact that it was unforeseen has never failed to intensify a person's grief. This is a reason for ensuring that nothing ever takes us by surprise. We should project our thoughts ahead of us at every turn, and have in mind every possible eventuality instead of only the usual course of events. For what is there that fortune does not, when she pleases, fell at the height of its powers? What is there that is not the more assailed and buffeted by her, the more lustrous its attraction? What is there that is troublesome or difficult for her? Her assaults do not always come along a single path, or even a well-recognized path. At one time she will call in the aid of her own hands in attacking us. At another, she will be content with her own powers in devising for us dangers for which no one is responsible. No moment is exempt. In the midst of pleasures there are found the springs of suffering. In the middle of peace, war rears its head, and the bulwarks of one's security are transformed into sources of alarm, friend turning foe, and ally turning enemy. The summer's calm is upset by sudden storms more severe than those of winter. In the absence of any enemy, we suffer all that an enemy might wreak on us. Overmuch prosperity, if all else fails, will hit on the instruments of its own destruction. Sickness assails those leading the most sensible lives. Tuberculosis, those with the strongest constitutions. Retribution, the utterly guiltless. Violence, the most secluded. Misfortune has a way of choosing some unprecedented means or other of impressing its power on those who might be said to have forgotten it. A single day strews in ruins all that was raised by a train of construction extending over a long span of time and involving a great number of separate works and a great deal of favour on the part of heaven. To say a day, indeed, is to put too much of a break on the calamities that hasten down upon us. An hour, an instant of time, suffices for the overthrow of empires. It would be some relief to our condition and our frailty if all things were as slow in their perishing as they were in their coming into being. But as it is, the growth of things is a tardy process, and their undoing is a rapid matter. Nothing is durable, whether for an individual or for a society. The destinies of men and cities alike sweep onwards. Terror strikes amid the most tranquil surroundings, and without any disturbance in the background to give rise to them. Calamities spring from the least expected quarter. States which stood firm through civil war as well as wars external collapse without a hand being raised against them. How few nations have made of their prosperity a lasting thing. This is why we need to envisage every possibility and to strengthen the spirit to deal with the things which may conceivably come about. Rehearse them in your mind. Exile, torture, war, shipwreck. Misfortune may snatch you away from your country, or your country away from you may banish you into some wilderness. These very surroundings in which the masses suffocate may become a wilderness. All the terms of our human lot should be before our eyes. We should be anticipating not merely all that commonly happens, but all that is conceivably capable of happening, if we do not want to be overwhelmed and struck numb by rare events, as if they were unprecedented ones. Fortune needs envisaging in a thoroughly comprehensive way. Think how often towns in Asia or in Greece have fallen at a single earth tremor. How many villages in Syria or Macedonia have been engulfed, how often this form of disaster has wrought devastation in Cyprus, how often Paphos has stumbled about itself. Time and again we hear the news of the annihilation of a whole city, and how small a fraction of mankind are we who hear such news thus often. So let us face up to the blows of circumstance, and be aware that whatever happens is never as serious as rumour makes it out to be. So a city has burned, a wealthy city, and the glory of the provinces of which it was a feature, though it stood in a class of its own, perched as it was on a single hill, and that not a hill of very great dimensions. But time will sweep away the very traces of every one of those cities, of whose splendour and magnificence you nowadays hear. Look at the way the very foundations of once famous cities of Greece have been eroded by now, to the point where nothing is left to show that they ever even existed. And it is not only the works of human hands that waste away, nor only structures raised by human skill and industry that the passing days demolish. Mountain massives crumble away. Whole regions have subsided. The waves have covered landmarks once far out of sight of the sea. The immense force of volcanic fires that once made the mountain tops glow has eaten them away and reduced to lowly stature what once were soaring peaks, reassuring beacons to the mariner. The works of nature herself suffer, so it is only right that we should bear the overthrow of cities with resignation. They stand just to fall. Such is the sum total of the end that awaits them, whether it be the blast of a subterranean explosion throwing off the restraining weight above it, or the violence of floodwaters increasing to a prodigious degree underground until it breaks down everything in its way, or a volcanic outburst fracturing the earth's crust, or age, to which nothing is immune, overcoming them little by little, or plague carrying off its population and causing the deserted area to decay. It would be tedious to recount all the different ways by which fate may overtake them. One thing I know, all the works of mortal man lie under sentence of mortality. We live among things that are destined to perish. Such, then, are the comforting reflections which I would offer our liberalis, who burns with a kind of passion beyond belief for his birthplace, which, it may be, has only been consumed so as to be called to higher things. A setback has often cleared the way for greater prosperity. Many things have fallen only to rise to more exalted heights. That opponent of affluence in the capital, Timagenes, used to declare that the one reason fires distressed him was the knowledge that what would rise up afterwards would be of a better standard than what had burned. In the city of Lyon, too, one may presume that everyone will endeavour to make the work of restoration a greater, more noble achievement than what they have lost. May that work be of lasting duration, and may the new foundation be attended by happier auspices, with a view to its lasting for a longer, and indeed for all time. This is the 100th year since the town came into being, and even for a human being, such an age is by no means the uttermost limit. Founded by Plancus, in an area of concentrated population, it owes its growth to its favourable situation. Yet how many grievous blows has it had to suffer in the time it takes for a man to grow old? So the spirit must be trained to a realization and an acceptance of its lot. It must come to see that there is nothing fortune will shrink from, that she wields the same authority over emperor and empire alike, and the same power over cities as over men. There's no ground for resentment in all this. We've entered into a world in which these are the terms life is lived on. If you're satisfied with that, submit to them. If you're not, get out, whatever way you please. Resent a thing by all means, if it represents an injustice decreed against yourself personally. But if this same constraint is binding on the lowest and the highest alike, then make your peace again with destiny, the destiny that unravels all ties. There's no justification for using our graves and all the variety of monuments we see bordering the highways as a measure of our stature. In the ashes all men are levelled. We're born unequal, we die equal. and my words apply as much to cities as to those who live in them. Ardea was taken, and so was Rome. The great lawgiver draws no distinctions between us according to our birth or the celebrity of our names, save only while we exist. On the reaching of mortality's end, he declares, "Away with snobbery! All that the earth carries shall forthwith be subject to one law without discrimination. When it comes to all we're required to go through, we're equals. No one is more vulnerable than the next man, and no one can be more sure of his surviving to the morrow." King Alexander of Macedon once took up the study of geometry. Poor fellow, inasmuch as he would thus find out how minute the earth really was, the earth of which he had possessed himself of a tiny part. Yes, poor fellow, I call him, for the reason that he was bound to discover that his title was a false one. For who can be great in an area of minute dimensions? Anyway, the points he was being instructed in were of some subtlety, and such that the learning of them demanded the closest concentration, not the sort of thing that would be grasped by a crazed individual projecting his thoughts across the seas. "Teach me," he said, "the easy things," to which his instructor answered, "These things are the same for everyone, equally difficult for all." Well, imagine that nature is saying to you, "Those things you grumble about are the same for everyone. I can give no one anything easier. But anyone who likes may make them easier for himself. How? By viewing them with equanimity. You must needs experience pain and hunger and thirst, and grow old, assuming that you are vouchsafed a relatively long stay among men, and be ill and suffer loss and finally perish. But you needn't believe the chatter of the people around you. There's nothing in all this that's evil, insupportable, or even hard. Those people are afraid of these things by a kind of general consent. Are you going to feel alarm at death, then, in the same way as you might at some common report? What could be more foolish than a man's being afraid of people's words? My friend Demetrius has a nice way of putting things when he says, as he commonly does, that to him the utterances of the unenlightened are as noises emanating from the belly. What difference does it make to me, he asks, whether their rumblings come from their upper or their nether regions? What utter foolishness it is to be afraid that those who have a bad name can rob you of a good one. Just as the dread aroused in you by some common report has proved groundless, so too is the dread of things of which you would never be afraid if common report did not tell you to be. What harm could ever come to a good man from being besmirched by unwarranted gossip? We shouldn't even let it prejudice us against death, which itself has an evil reputation. Yet none of the people who malign it has put it to the test. Until one does, it's rather rash to condemn a thing one knows nothing about. And yet one thing you do know, and that is this: how many people it's a blessing to, how many people it frees from torture, want, maladies, suffering, weariness. And no one has power over us when death is within our own power. Letter number 104. I've got away to my place at Nomentum. Getting away from what? Guess. The city? No. A fever. And just as it was infiltrating my defences, too. It had already taken hold on me, my doctor being decided, in his opinion, that a disturbed, irregular pulse, its natural rhythm upset, was the start of it. Whereupon I immediately ordered my carriage out, and although my Paulina tried to hold me back, insisted on driving away. I kept saying the same thing as my mentor, Gallio, when he started sickening for a fever in Achaia. He immediately boarded a ship, assuring everyone that the disorder was to be put down to the place where he was living and not to his constitution. I told Paulina this. She is forever urging me to take care of my health, and indeed, as I come to realize the way her very being depends on mine, I am beginning in my concern for her to feel some concern for myself. So, although old age has made me better at putting up with a lot of things, here I am coming to lose this advantage of being old. The notion occurs to me that inside this old frame there exists a young man as well, and one is always less severe on a young man. The consequence is that since I haven't managed to get her to put a little more bravery into her love for me, she has managed to induce me to show a little more love and care for myself. For concessions have to be made to legitimate emotions. There are times when, however pressing one's reasons to the contrary, one's dying breath requires to be summoned back and held back, even as it is passing one's lips, even if this amounts to torture, simply out of consideration for one's dear ones. The good man should go on living as long as he ought to, not just as long as he likes. The man who does not value his wife or a friend highly enough to stay on a little longer in life, who persists in dying in spite of them, is a thoroughly self-indulgent character. This is a duty which the soul should also impose on itself when it is merely the convenience of near and dear ones that demands it, and not only if and when it feels the wish to die, but also if and when it has begun to carry out the wish, it should pause a while to fit in with their interests. To return to life for another's sake is a sign of a noble spirit. It is something that great men have done on a number of occasions. Yet, to give your old age greater care and attentiveness in the realization that this pleases any of the persons closest to you, or is in their interests, or would be likely to gratify them, and this in spite of the fact that the greatest reward of that period is the opportunity it gives you to adopt a relatively carefree attitude towards looking after yourself and a more adventurous manner of living, is also, to my mind, a mark of the highest possible kindness. Besides, it brings you more than a little pleasure and recompense. For can anything be sweeter than to find that you are so dear to your wife that this makes you dearer to yourself? So it comes about that my Paulina succeeds in making me responsible for anxiety of my own, as well as hers on my behalf. I expect you're keen to hear what effect it had on my health, this decision of mine to leave. Well, no sooner had I left behind the oppressive atmosphere of the city, and that reek of smoking cookers which pour out, along with a cloud of ashes, all the poisonous fumes they've accumulated in their interiors whenever they're started up, then I noticed the change in my condition at once. You can imagine how much stronger I felt after reaching my vineyards. I fairly waded into my food. Talk about animals just turned out onto spring grass. So, by now I'm quite my old self again. That feeling of listlessness, being bodily ill at ease and mentally inefficient, didn't last. I'm beginning to get down to some wholehearted work. This is not something, however, to which mere surroundings are conducive, unless the mind is at its own disposal, able at will to provide its own seclusion, even in crowded moments. On the contrary, the man who spends his time choosing one resort after another in a hunt for peace and quiet will, in every place he visits, find something to prevent him from relaxing. The story is told that someone complained to Socrates that travelling abroad had never done him any good, and received the reply, "What else can you expect, seeing that you always take yourself along with you when you go abroad? What a blessing it would be for some people if they could only lose themselves. As things are, these persons are a worry and a burden, a source of demoralization and anxiety to their own selves. What good does it do you to go overseas, to move from city to city? If you really want to escape the things that harass you, what you're needing is not to be in a different place, but to be a different person. Suppose you've arrived in Athens, or suppose it's Rhodes. Choose any country you like. What difference does the character of the place make? You'll only be importing your own with you. You'll still look on wealth as a thing to be valued. Your poverty will be causing you torment, while, this being the most pathetic thing about it all, your poverty will be imaginary. However much you possess, there's someone else who has more, and you'll be fancying yourself to be short of things you need to the exact extent to which you lag behind him. Another thing that you'll regard as something to be valued is success in public life, in which case you're going to feel resentment when so-and-so is elected consul, or when so-and-so is re-elected, for that matter, and be jealous whenever you see a person's name appearing too often in the honours lists. Your ambition will be running at so feverish a pitch that if anyone's ahead of you in the race, you'll see yourself as coming last. Death you'll think of as the worst of all bad things. Though, in fact, there's nothing bad about it at all. except the thing which comes before it, the fear of it. You'll be scared stiff by illusory as well as genuine dangers, haunted by imaginary alarms. What good will it do you to have found a route past all those Argive forts and one escape right through the enemy's lines? Peace itself will supply you with new fears. If your mind has once experienced the shocks of fright, you'll no longer have any confidence, even in things which are perfectly safe. Once it has acquired the habit of unthinking panic, it is incapable even of attending to its own self-preservation, for it runs away from dangers instead of taking steps to avert them, and we're far more exposed to them once our backs are turned. To lose someone you love is something you'll regard as the hardest of all blows to bear. While all the time, this will be as silly as crying because the leaves fall from the beautiful trees that add to the charm of your home. Preserve a sense of proportion in your attitude to everything that pleases you, and make the most of them while they are at their best. At one moment, chance will carry off one of them, at another moment another. But the falling of the leaves is not difficult to bear, since they grow again, and it is no more hard to bear the loss of those whom you love and regard as brightening your existence. For even if they do not grow again, they are replaced. But their successors will never be quite the same. No, and neither will you. Every day, every hour, sees a change in you, although the ravages of time are easier to see in others. In your own case, they are far less obvious because to you they do not show. While other people are snatched away from us, we are being filched away surreptitiously from ourselves. Are you never going to give any of these considerations any thought, and never going to apply any healing treatment to your wounds, instead of sowing the seeds of worry for yourself by hoping for this or that, or despairing of obtaining this or that other thing? If you're sensible, you'll run the two together, and never hope without an element of despair, never despair without an element of hope. What good has travel of itself ever been able to do anyone? It has never acted as a check on pleasure or restraining influence on desires. It has never controlled the temper of an angry man or quelled the reckless impulses of a lover. Never, in fact, has it rid the personality of a fault. It has not granted us the gift of judgment. It has not put an end to mistaken attitudes. All it has ever done is distract us for a little while through the novelty of our surroundings, like children fascinated by something they haven't come across before. The instability, moreover, of a mind which is seriously unwell is aggravated by it, the motion itself increasing the fitfulness and restlessness. This explains why people, after setting out for a place with the greatest of enthusiasm, are often more enthusiastic about getting away from it. Like migrant birds, they fly on, away even quicker than they came. Travel will give you a knowledge of other countries. It will show you mountains whose outlines are quite new to you, stretches of unfamiliar plains, valleys watered by perennial streams. It will allow you to observe the unique features of this or that river, the way in which, for example, the Nile rises in summer flood, or the Tigris vanishes from sight and at the completion of its journey through hidden subterranean regions is restored to view with its volume undiminished. Or the way the meander, theme of every poet's early training exercises, winds about, loop after loop, and again is carried close to its own bed, and then once more diverted into a different course before it can flow into its own stream. But travel won't make a better or saner man of you. For this, we must spend time in study, and in the writings of wise men, to learn the truths that have emerged from their researches, and carry on the search ourselves, for the answers that have not yet been discovered. This is the way to liberate the spirit, that still needs to be rescued from its miserable state of slavery. So long, in fact, as you remain in ignorance of what to aim at and what to avoid, what is essential and what is superfluous, what is upright or honourable conduct and what is not, it will not be travelling, but drifting. All this hurrying from place to place won't bring you any relief, for you're travelling in the company of your own emotions, followed by your troubles all the way. If only they were really following you, they'd be farther away from you. As it is, they're not at your back, but on it. That's why they weigh you down with just the same uncomfortable chafing wherever you are. It's medicine, not a particular part of the world, that a person needs if he's ill. Suppose someone has broken his leg or dislocated a joint. He doesn't get into a carriage or board a ship. He calls in a doctor to have the fracture set or the dislocation reduced. Well, then, when a person's spirit is wrenched or broken at so many points, do you imagine that it can be put right by a change of scenery, that that sort of trouble isn't so serious that it can't be cured by an outing? Travelling doesn't make a man a doctor or a public speaker. There isn't a single art which is acquired merely by being in one place rather than another. Can wisdom, then, the greatest art of all, be picked up in the course of taking a trip? Take my word for it. The trip doesn't exist that can set you beyond the reach of cravings, fits of temper, or fears. If it did, the human race would be off there in a body. So long as you carry the sources of your troubles about with you, those troubles will continue to harass and plague you. Wherever you wander, on land or on sea, does it surprise you that running away doesn't do you any good? The things you're running away from are with you all the time. What you must do is mend your ways and get rid of the burden you're carrying. Keep your cravings within safe limits. Scour every trace of evil from your personality. If you want to enjoy your travel, you must make your travelling companion a healthy one. So long as you associate with a person who's mean and grasping, you will remain a money-minded individual yourself. So long as you keep arrogant company, just so long will conceit stick to you. Cruelty you'll never say goodbye to while you share the same roof with a torturer. Familiarity with adulterers will only inflame your desires. If you wish to be stripped of your vices, you must get right away from the examples others set of them. The miser, the swindler, the bully, the cheat, who would do you a lot of harm by simply being near you, are actually inside you. Move to better company. Live with the Catos, with Lelius, with Tubero. If you like Greek company, too, attach yourself to Socrates and Zeno. The one would teach you how to die, should it be forced upon you, the other how to die before it is forced upon you. Live with Chrysippus, live with Posidonius. They will give you a knowledge of man and the universe. They will tell you to be a practical philosopher, not just to entertain your listeners to a clever display of language, but to steel your spirit and brace it against whatever threatens. For the only safe harbour in this life's tossing, troubled sea is to refuse to be bothered about what the future will bring, and to stand ready and confident, squaring in the breast, to take, without skulking or flinching, whatever fortune hurls at us. When she created us, nature endowed us with noble aspirations. And just as she gave certain animals ferocity, others timidity, others cunning, so to us she gave a spirit of exalted ambition, a spirit that takes us in search of a life of not the greatest safety, but the greatest honour, a spirit very like the universe, which, so far as mortal footsteps may, it follows and adopts as a model. It is self-assertive. It feels assured of honour and respect. It is master of all things. It is above all things. It should accordingly give in to nothing. In nothing should it see a burden, calculated to bow the shoulders of a man. Shapes frightening to the sight, hardship and death, are not so at all, if one can break through the surrounding darkness and look directly at them. Many other things that have caused terror during the night and been turned into matter of laughter with the coming of daylight. Shapes frightening to the sight, hardship and death. Our Virgil perfectly rightly says that they are frightening not in reality, but to the sight. In other words, that they seem so, but in fact are not. Just what is there about them that is as terrifying as legend would have us believe? Why, Lucilius, I ask you, why should any real man be afraid of hardship, or any human being be afraid of death? I constantly meet people who think that what they themselves can't do can't be done, who say that to bear up under the things we Stoics speak of is beyond the capacity of human nature. How much more highly I rate these people's abilities than they do themselves. I say that they are just as capable as others of doing these things, but won't. In any event, what person actually trying them has found them prove beyond him? Who hasn't noticed how much easier they are in the actual doing? It's not because they're hard that we lose confidence. They're hard because we lack the confidence. If you still need an example, take Socrates. an old man who had known his full share of suffering, who had taken every blow life could inflict, and still remained unbeaten either by poverty, a burden for him aggravated by domestic worries, or by constant hardships, including those endured on military service. Apart from what he had to contend with at home, whether one thinks of his wife with her shrewish ways and nagging tongue, or his intractable children, more like their mother than their father, his whole life was lived either in wartime or under tyranny, or under a democracy that outdid even wars and tyrants in its cruelties. The war went on for 27 years. After the fighting was ended, the state was handed over to the mercy of the 30 tyrants, a considerable number of whom were hostile to him. The final blow was his conviction and sentence on the most serious of charges. He was accused of blasphemy and of corrupting the younger generation, whom, it was alleged, he turned into rebels against God, their fathers, and the state. After that came the prison and the poison. And so little effect did all this have on Socrates' spirit, it did not even affect the expression on his face. What a rare and wonderful story of achievement! To the very last, no one ever saw Socrates in any particular mood of gaiety or depression. Through all the ups and downs of fortune, his was a level temperament. Would you like another example? Take the modern one of Marcus Cato, with whom fortune dealt in an even more belligerent and unremitting fashion. At every point she stood in his way, even at the end, at his death. Yet he demonstrated that a brave man can live in defiance of fortune, and can die in defiance of fortune. The whole of his life was passed either in civil war, or in conditions of developing civil conflict. And of him, no less than of Socrates, it is possible to say that he carried himself clear of slavery. Unless, perhaps, you take the view that Pompey, Caesar, and Crassus were friends of freedom. When his country was in a state of constant change, no one ever saw a change in Cato. In every situation he was placed in, he showed himself always the same man, whether in office as praetor, in defeat at the polls, under attack in court, as governor in his province, on the public platform, in the field, or in death itself. In that moment, too, of panic for the Republic, when Caesar stood on the one side, backed by 10 legions of the finest fighting men, and the entire resources and support of foreign countries as well, and on the other stood Pompey, by himself a match for all comers, and when people were moving to join either the one or the other, Cato, all on his own, established something of a party pledged to fight for the Republic. If you try to picture the period to yourself, you will see on the one side the populace, the mob, all agog for revolution, on the other the time-honoured elect of Rome, the aristocracy and knighthood, and 2 forlorn figures, Cato and republicanism, between them. You will find it an impressive sight, I can assure you, as you watch. The son of Atreus and King Priam with Achilles' wrath with both. For there is Cato denouncing each of them, trying to disarm the pair of them, and the way he casts his vote between them is, if Caesar wins, I kill myself, if Pompey, I go into exile. What had a man to fear who, win or lose, had dictated to himself such a choice of fates as might have been decreed him by an utterly exasperated enemy? And that is how he came to die, carrying out his own self-sentence. You will see, too, the capacity of man for hardship. On foot at the head of his troops, he crossed the deserts of North Africa. You see that thirst can be endured as well. Always in armour, trailing over a sun-baked plateau, the remnants of a beaten army, an army without supplies. He was invariably the last to drink whenever they came upon water. You see that a man can think equally little of either the distinction of office or the stigma of rejection. On the day of his election defeat, he played fives at the place of polling. You see that men can defy the might of their superiors, for with no one daring offend either Caesar or Pompey, except to curry favour with the other, Cato challenged the pair of them simultaneously. You see that a man can think as little of death as of exile. He condemned himself to both, and war in the meantime. We then can show a spirited an attitude to just the same things, if we will only choose to slip the yoke from our necks. But first we have to reject the life of pleasures. They make us soft and womanish. They are insistent in their demands, and what is more, require us to make insistent demands on fortune. And then we need to look down on wealth, which is the wage of slavery. Gold and silver and everything else that clutters our prosperous homes should be discarded. Freedom cannot be won without sacrifice. If you set a high value on her, everything else must be valued at little. Letter 105. Yes, I'll give you some rules to observe that will enable you to live in greater safety. You, for your part, I suggest you listen as carefully to the advice I give you as you would if I were advising you on how to look after your health at Ardea. Now think of the things which goad man into destroying man. You'll find that they are hope, envy, hatred, fear, and contempt. Contempt is the least important of the lot, so much so that a number of men have actually taken shelter behind it, for protection's sake. For if a person feels contempt for someone, he tramples on him doubtless, but he passes on. No one pursues an unremitting and persistent policy of injury to a man for whom he feels nothing but contempt. Even in battle, the man on the ground is left alone, the fighting being with those still on their feet. Coming to hope, so long as you own nothing likely to arouse the greed or grasping instinct of others, so long as you possess nothing out of the ordinary, for people covet even the smallest things if they are rare or little known, you'll have nothing to worry about from the hopes of grasping characters. Envy, you'll escape if you haven't obtruded yourself on other people's notice, if you haven't flaunted your possessions, if you've learnt to keep your satisfaction to yourself. Hatred either comes from giving offence, and that you'll avoid by refraining from deliberately provoking anyone, or is quite uncalled for. Here your safeguard will be ordinary tact. It is a kind of hatred that has been a source of danger to a lot of people. Men have been hated without having any actual enemy. As regards not being feared, a moderate fortune and an easy-going nature will secure you that. People should see that you are not a person it is dangerous to offend, and with you a reconciliation should be both easy and dependable. To be feared inside your own home, it may be added, is as much a source of trouble as being feared outside it. Slave or free, there isn't a man who hadn't power enough to do you injury. Besides, to be feared is to fear. No one has been able to strike terror into others and at the same time enjoy peace of mind himself. There remains contempt. The person who has made contempt his ally, who has been despised because he has chosen to be despised, has the measure of it under his control. Its disadvantages are negatived by the possession of respected qualities and of friends having influence with some person with the necessary influence. Such influential friends are people with whom it is well worth having ties, without being so tied up with them that their protection costs you more than the original danger might have done. But nothing will help quite so much as just keeping quiet, talking with other people as little as possible, with yourself as much as possible. For conversation has a kind of charm about it, an insinuating and insidious something that elicits secrets from us just like love or liquor. Nobody will keep the things he hears to himself, and nobody will repeat just what he hears and no more. Neither will anyone who has failed to keep a story to himself keep the name of his informant to himself. Every person, without exception, has someone to whom he confides everything that is confided to himself. Even supposing he puts some guard on his garrulous tongue and is content with a single pair of ears, he will be the creator of a host of later listeners. Such is the way in which what was but a little while before a secret becomes common rumour. Never to wrong others takes one a long way towards peace of mind. People who know no self-restraint lead stormy and disordered lives, passing their time in a state of fear, commensurate with the injuries they do to others, never able to relax. After every act they tremble, paralysed, their consciences continually demanding an answer, not allowing them to get on with other things. To expect punishment is to suffer it, and to earn it is to expect it. Where there is a bad conscience, some circumstance or other may provide one with impunity, but never with freedom from anxiety. For a person takes the attitude that even if he isn't found out, there's always the possibility of it. His sleep is troubled. Whenever he talks about someone else's misdeed, he thinks of his own, which seems to him all too inadequately hidden, all too inadequately blotted out of people's memories. A guilty person sometimes has the luck to escape detection, but never to feel sure of it. Letter number 107. Where's that moral insight of yours? Where's that acuteness of perception, or magnanimity? Does something as trivial as that upset you? Your slaves have seen your absorption in business as their chance to run away. So be it. You have been let down by friends. For by all means, keep the name we mistakenly bestowed on them, and be called such just to heighten their disgrace. But the fact is that your affairs have been freed for good, and all of a number of people on whom all your trouble was being wasted, and who considered you insufferable to anyone but yourself. There's nothing unusual or surprising about it all. To be put out by this sort of thing is as ridiculous as grumbling about being spattered in the street or getting dirty where it's muddy. One has to accept life on the same terms as the public baths or crowds or travel. Things will get thrown at you and things will hit you. Life's no soft affair. It's a long road you started on. You can't but expect to have slips and knocks and falls and get tired and openly wish a lie for death. At one place you will part from a companion, at another bury one, and be afraid of one at another. These are the kind of things you'll come up against all along this rugged journey. Wanting to die? Let the personality be made ready to face everything. Let it be made to realize that it has come to terrain on which thunder and lightning play, terrain on which grief and vengeful care have set their couch, and pallid sickness dwells, and drear old age. This is the company in which you must live out your days. Escape them you cannot, scorn them you can, and scorn them you will, if by constant reflection you have anticipated future happenings. Everyone faces up more bravely to a thing for which he has long prepared himself, sufferings even being withstood if they have been trained for in advance. Those who are unprepared, on the other hand, are panic-stricken by the most insignificant happenings. We must see to it that nothing takes us by surprise. And since it is invariably unfamiliarity that makes the thing more formidable than it really is, this habit of continual reflection will ensure that no form of adversity finds you a complete beginner. I've been deserted by my slaves. Others have been plundered, incriminated, set upon, betrayed, beaten up, attacked with poison or with calumny. Mention anything you like. It has happened to plenty of people. A vast variety of missiles are launched with us as their target. Some are planted in our flesh already. Some are hurtling towards us at this very moment. Others merely grazing us in passing on their way to other targets. Let's not be taken aback by any of the things we're born to, things no one need complain at, for the simple reason that they're the same for everybody. Yes, the same for everybody. For even if a man does escape something, it was a thing which he might have suffered. The fairness of a law does not consist in its effect being actually felt by all alike, but in its having been laid down for all alike. Let's get this sense of justice firmly into our heads, and pay up, without grumbling, the taxes arising from our mortal state. Winter brings in the cold, and we have to shiver. Summer brings back the heat, and we have to swelter. Bad weather tries the health, and we have to be ill. Somewhere or other we are going to have encounters with wild beasts, and with man, too, more dangerous than all those beasts. Floods will rob us of one thing, fire of another. These are conditions of our existence which we cannot change. What we can do is adopt a noble spirit, such a spirit as befits a good man, so that we may bear up bravely under all that fortune sends us, and bring our wills into tune with nature's. Reversals, after all, are the means by which nature regulates this visible realm of hers. Clear skies follow cloudily. After the calm comes the storm. The winds take turns to blow. Day succeeds night. While part of the heavens is in the ascendant, another is sinking. It is by means of opposites that eternity endures. This is the law to which our minds are needing to be reconciled. This is the law they should be following and obeying. They should assume that whatever happens was bound to happen, and refrain from railing at nature. One can do nothing better than endure what cannot be cured, and attend uncomplainingly the God at whose instance all things come about. It is a poor soldier that follows his commander grumbling. So let us receive our orders readily and cheerfully, and not desert the ranks along the march. The march of this glorious fabric of creation, in which everything we shall suffer is a strand. And let us address Jupiter, whose guiding hand directs this mighty work, in the way our own Cleanthes did, in some most expressive lines, which I may perhaps be pardoned for translating, in view of the example set here by that master of expressiveness, Cicero. If you like them, so much the better. If not, you will at least know that I was following Cicero's example. Lead me, master of the soaring vault of heaven, lead me, father, where you will. I stand here prompt and eager to obey. And even suppose I were unwilling, still I should attend you and know suffering, dishonourably and grumbling, when I might have done so and been good as well. For fate the willing leads, the unwilling drags along. Let us speak and live like that. Let fate find us ready and eager. Here is your noble spirit, the one which has put itself in the hands of fate. On the other side we have the puny, degenerate spirit, which struggles, and which sees nothing right in the way the universe is ordered, and would rather reform the gods than reform itself. Letter number 108. The subject you ask me about is one of those in which knowledge has no other justification than the knowledge itself. Nevertheless, and just because it is so justified, you are in a great hurry and reluctant to wait for the Encyclopedia of Ethics I'm compiling at this very moment. Well, I shall let you have your answer immediately, but first I'm going to tell you how this enthusiasm for learning, with which I can see you're on fire, is to be brought under control if it isn't going to stand in its own way. What is wanted is neither haphazard dipping nor a greedy onslaught on knowledge in the mass. The whole will be reached through its parts, and the burden must be adjusted to our strength. We mustn't take on more than we can manage. You shouldn't attempt to absorb all you want to, just what you've room for. Simply adopt the right approach, and you will end up with room for all you want. The more the mind takes in, the more it expands. I remember a piece of advice which Attalus gave me in the days when I practically laid siege to his lecture hall, always first to arrive and last to go, and would draw him into a discussion of some point or other, even when he was out taking a walk, for he was always readily available to his students, not just accessible. A person teaching and a person learning, he said, should have the same end in view, the improvement of the latter. A person who goes to a philosopher should carry away with him something or other of value every day. He should return home a sounder man, or at least more capable of becoming one. And he will, for the power of philosophy is such that she helps not only those who devote themselves to her, but also those who come into contact with her. A person going out into the sun, whether or not this is what he is going out for, will acquire a tan. Customers who sit around rather too long in a shop selling perfumes carry the scent of the place away with them. And people who have been with a philosopher are bound to have derived from it something of benefit even to the inattentive. Note that I say inattentive, not the hostile. That's all very well, but don't we all know certain people who have sat at a philosopher's feet year after year without acquiring even a semblance of wisdom? Of course I do. Persevering, conscientious people, too. I prefer to call them a philosopher's squatters, not students. Some come not to learn, but just to hear him, in the same way as we're drawn to a theatre for the sake of entertainment, to treat our ears to a play or music or an address. You'll find that a large proportion of the philosopher's audience is made up of this element, which regards his lecture hall as a place of lodging for periods of leisure. They're not concerned to rid themselves of any faults there or acquire any rule of life by which to test their characters, but simply to enjoy to the full the pleasures the ear has to offer. Admittedly, some of them actually come with notebooks, but with a view to recording not the content of the lecture, but words from it, to be passed on to others with the same lack of profit to the hearer as they themselves derived from hearing them. Some of them are stirred by the noble sentiments they hear. Their faces and spirits light up, and they enter into the emotions of the speaker, going into a transport just like the eunuch priests who work themselves into a frenzy to order at the sound of a Phrygian flute. They are captivated and aroused not by a din of empty words, but by the splendour of the actual content of the speaker's words. Any expression of bold or spirited defiance of death or fortune, making you keen to translate what you've heard into action straight away. They are deeply affected by the words, and become the persons they are told to be, or would if the impression on their minds were to last, if this magnificent enthusiasm were not immediately intercepted by that discourager of noble conduct, the crowd. Very few succeed in getting home in the same frame of mind. It is easy enough to arouse in a listener a desire for what is honourable, for in every one of us nature has laid the foundations or sown the seeds of the virtues. We are born to them all of us. And when a person comes along with the necessary stimulus, then those qualities of the personality are awakened, so to speak, from their slumber. Haven't you noticed how the theatre murmurs agreement whenever something is spoken, the truth of which we generally recognise and unanimously confirm? The poor lack much, the greedy everything. The greedy man does no one any good, but harms no person more than his own self. Your worst miser will clap these lines, and be delighted at hearing his own faults lashed in this manner. Imagine how much more likely it is that this will happen when such things are being said by a philosopher, interspersing passages of sound advice with lines of poetry calculated to deepen their hold on unenlightened minds. For the constricting requirements of verse, as Cleanthes used to say, give one's meaning all the greater force, in the same way as one's breath produces a far greater noise when it is channelled through a trumpet's long and narrow tube before its final expulsion through the widening opening at the end. The same things stated in prose are listened to with less attention and have much less impact. When a rhythm is introduced, when a fine idea is compressed into a definite metre, the very same thought comes hurtling at one like a missile launched from a fully extended arm. A lot, for example, is said about despising money. The listener is told at very considerable length that men should look on riches as consisting in the spirit and not in inherited estates, and that a man is wealthy if he has attuned himself to his restricted means and has made himself rich on little. But verses such as the following he finds a good deal more striking. He needs but little who desires but little. He has his wish, whose wish can be to have what is enough. When we hear these lines and others like them, we feel impelled to admit the truth. The people for whom nothing is ever enough admire and applaud such a verse and publicly declare their distaste for money. When you see them in such a mood, keep at them and drive this home, piling it on them, having nothing to do with plays on words, syllogisms, sophistries, and all the other toys of sterile intellectual cleverness. Speak out against the love of money. Speak out against extravagance. When you see that you've achieved something and had an effect on your listeners, lay on all the harder. It's hardly believable how much can be achieved by this sort of speech, aimed at curing people, wholly directed to the good of people listening. When the character is impressionable, it is easily won over to a passion for what is noble and honourable. While a person's character is still malleable, and only corrupted to a mild degree, truth strikes deep if she finds the right kind of advocate. For my part, at any rate, when I hear Attalus winding up the case against the faults of character, the mistaken attitudes and the evils generally of the lives we lead, I frequently felt a sense of the sorry plight of the human race, and looked on him as a kind of sublime being who has risen higher than the limits of human aspiration. He himself would use the Stoic term king of himself. But to me he seemed more than a king, as being a man who had the right to pass judgment on the conduct and the character of monarchs. And when he began extolling to us the virtues of poverty, and showing us how everything which went beyond our actual needs was just so much unnecessary weight, a burden to the man who had to carry it, I often had a longing to walk out of that lecture hall a poor man. When he started exposing our pleasures and commending to us, along with moderation in our diet, physical purity and a mind equally uncontaminated not only by illicit pleasures, but by unnecessary ones as well, I would become enthusiastic about keeping the appetites for food and drink firmly in their place. With the result that some of this, Lucilius, has lasted with me right through life, for I started out on it all with tremendous energy and enthusiasm, and later, after my return to public life, I managed to retain a few of the principles as regards which I had made this promising beginning. This is how I came to give up oysters and mushrooms for the rest of my life, for they aren't really food to us, but titbits, which induce people who have already had as much as they can take to go on eating, the object most desired by gluttons and others who stuff themselves with more than they can hold, being items which will come up again as easily as they go down. This, too, is why throughout life I have always abstained from using scent, as the best smell a body can have is no smell at all. This is why no wine ever finds its way into my stomach. This is the reason for my lifelong avoidance of hot baths, believing as I do that it is effeminate as well as pointless to stew one's body and exhaust it with continual sweating. Some other things to which I once said goodbye have made their reappearance, but nevertheless, in these cases, in which I have ceased to practice total abstinence, I succeed in observing a limit, which is something hardly more than a step removed from total abstinence, and even perhaps more difficult, with some things less effort of will is required to cut them out altogether, and I have recourse to them in moderation. Now that I've started disclosing to you how much greater my enthusiasm was in taking up philosophy as a young man than it is when it comes to keeping it up in my old age, I shan't be ashamed to confess the passionate feelings which Pythagoras inspired in me. Sotion used to tell us why Pythagoras and later Sextius was a vegetarian. Each had a quite different reason, but each was a striking one. Sextius believed that man had enough food to sustain him without shedding blood, and that when men took this tearing of flesh so far that it became a pleasure, a habit of cruelty was formed. He argued, in addition, that the scope for people's extravagance was in any case something that should be reduced, and he gave reasons for inferring that variety of diet was incompatible with our physical makeup and inimical to health. Pythagoras, on the other hand, maintained that all creatures were interrelated, and that there was a system of exchange of souls, involving transmigration from one bodily form to another. If we are to believe Pythagoras, no soul ever undergoes death, or even a suspension of his existence, except perhaps for the actual moment of transfusion into another body. This is not the moment for inquiring by what stages or at what point a soul completes its wanderings through a succession of other habitations and reverts to